Okay, good morning, everybody. Most of you know me, but those who don't, I'm David Knox, and welcome to this session, and concurrent session 7. We're going to talk about product rationalisation for this session, so if you don't want to talk about that, now's the time to leave, if you think you're in the wrong session. It's my pleasure to introduce Guy Thorburn to talk on this topic of product rationalisation in our industry. Those who heard the Minister speak yesterday, he spoke about it. So it is a hot topic. It's a very relevant topic. Guy works for Mercer and is a principal at Mercer and has been working for Mercer for more than 10 years. Before that, he was with Colonial. He provides strategic advice and prudential advice to a number of financial services organisations, including life companies, friendly societies and retail fund managers. He's also a member of Treasury's expert panel committee that they have set up to look at this very matter. So you've heard enough from me. I'll now hand over to Guy.
I should add, Guy will speak for about 25 to 30 minutes and then we'll take questions and discussion.
Okay, thank you all for coming along. It's nice to see some familiar faces in the audience. This is the first time I've actually stood up and done this at an institute thing, so I'm a little nervous, but hopefully we'll do it justice. So welcome. And as David said, product rationalisation is presently a bit of a hot topic. We were treated to a session earlier. This is the second session at this forum on it. We've had a couple of Institute Horizons forums. The previous session that Sean ran, I think I saw, who's walked in, focused a bit more on the background and also the process for implementing product rationalisation. This session will focus a bit more on the detail of the product rationalisation mechanism and the issues that are being debated in order to try and come up with a new mechanism. So hopefully that will generate some healthy discussion after I've provided you with some general information. In the hope of stimulating some discussion, I did post a paper on this topic on the Institute's website. I hope some of you might have read it because it does take quite a bit of effort to put those things together. But nonetheless, I won't be too presumptuous, and certainly this morning's presentation won't assume that you've completed any particular pre-reading. With that in mind, I'll start off with a very small amount of background in terms of where we're at in this whole process. It was outlined fairly comprehensively by Senator Sherratty. Rationalisation is not new. We've had rationalisation processes available to us for some time, particularly with the successor fund transfer process for superannuation funds, and a friendly society product rationalisation process has been in existence. Both have been around for some time, arguably since last century, which makes it sound like a particularly long time now. However, we don't really have an effective mechanism for life insurance or managed investment schemes. Against a background of industry rationalisation and regulatory change, the financial services industry has been lobbying government for many years now to broaden rationalisation processes so that they might be available to a wider range of products. The culmination of that was in 2007 when Treasury called for submissions regarding the issues related to a product rationalisation process. So that's pretty much the past. What's happening right now? Well, the Institute launched itself into the debate and has been contributing heavily, which is great. It's developed a submission along with key industry bodies and major industry participants. I think you put one in, didn't you, Jason? Yep, we put one in, and so quite a number, and some other individual actuaries also, which is great. So it wasn't actually just the Institute's formal submission. There are other individuals who did put a submission into Treasury as well. Pleasingly, the new government, well, it was last year, and of course we had an election in between, but the new government hasn't missed a beat, and Treasury, it's confirmed its commitment, and that's been backed up with Treasury forming this expert panel, as was outlined by Senator Sherry yesterday. Now, I can say that it's fairly early days. We've actually only met a couple of times, so it's early in the process, but nonetheless, it's terrific to see that that has come together and that there is ongoing consultation. So what of the future? Well, I think as an actuary we all learn never to make a short-term prediction, and the good news is it probably is a short-term prediction. There is terrific momentum underway on this topic at the moment, and we probably right now have our best opportunity to try and bring industry views together and see if we can't create something that is really going to be of benefit to investors in these products and to product providers alike. So it's a great opportunity we have and a very exciting time. So we'll touch briefly on the two existing mechanisms that have been used, but we're all pretty familiar with superannuation. Broadly, the successor fund or the receiving product has to provide equivalence of rights, which is, as a bundle, the rights have to be considered to be equivalent. And, of course, trustees, in exercising their duties as trustees, have to act in the members' interests. The decision is a trustee decision, so in essence the product provider is making the decision, and that's accompanied by disclosure regimes and complaints mechanisms. Before we contrast that with friendly societies, I think we should note that the successor fund transfer mechanism is in fact a very effective mechanism, and as we discussed a bit earlier today as well, much can be achieved without sitting and waiting for changes in the regulatory environment. Politicians won't solve all our problems, and we can do stuff now, and the existing SFT mechanism is extremely effective and something not to be overlooked. Friendly societies. Now, not everyone deals with friendly societies. I'm appointed actuary to three and had exposure, therefore, to the process. But there's some slight differences, which brings out the sorts of considerations that are there in the industry. The process does require expert advice. So in this case, it's the appointed actuary, and they have to comment on the impact on members and particularly give consideration to potential where unfairness to members might pop up, which is an interesting term to contemplate what the meaning of unfairness actually is, but that's what's required. The process is actually put to a member vote. There is provision for APRA to permit the approval of things like this by board resolution of the product provider. Having said that, in the context of the changes that we are talking about, that's probably less likely these days, but it's not inconceivable that that would be okay, that would be allowed, and there's a mechanism to allow that to happen. The disclosure regime is different, somewhat in detail, but it's a process of calling a meeting, explaining what's being considered at a meeting, bringing members together to discuss the changes and to vote on them, and that's a piece of feedback as well that happens. So it's quite a different process of communication to the issuing of pre-communications that happens with PDSs and things like that in a successor fund transfer environment. So the disclosure mechanism is different. The member vote itself, of course, throws up issues, and the issues are what happens when a minority of people turn up to vote who perhaps aren't truly representative of the wider membership, and what does the organisation do if an otherwise sound proposal gets voted down or derailed by a small group of active members. So the member vote process isn't perfect, and it really is a bit of an area of some uncertainty for providers. The other interesting part is that little bot at the bottom, APRA registration. In effect, APRA approves the rules or registers rules of friendly societies. So in a way, we have the regulator actually approving of a rationalisation or by approving of the proposed changes to members by registering those changes. So you have an element of regulatory approval which comes into play. So it's not that we all use those processes every day, and it's not that we have them available to us. If you're a life company, that neither of those are available, so it becomes quite academic. But it's interesting to contrast different mechanisms and see what elements are coming into the mechanisms in different environments. So what sort of principles? Well, I was told once that people get married over common values and then they divorce over which side of the cupboard the salt gets stored on. And there's a lot of principles that I think people have articulated and that do bring us closer together as the various industry bodies. I won't list them up on the slide, but they are things like consistency. People generally, from what I'm hearing, would like a consistency of process across different product groups and across different groups of investors. I'd like something that's simple to understand, easy to apply, easy to explain. Consumer safeguards are a big thing that people would look to being present, and it's very hard to argue against reasonable levels of protection for the investor. The process needs to be practical. Now, that's interesting, but The circumstances in which an organisation might seek to rationalise its products can be quite varied. They can be large products or they can be small products. And equally, they can be large providers or small providers. So there's quite a range of circumstances that will be faced in rationalising products, and the process needs to be practical and try and deal with all of those circumstances. Obviously, the process needs to be equitable. The process should also be transparent, so people would like a process that's not only fair but something that can be seen to be fair and incorporates elements that allow the product providers to demonstrate that a fair and reasonable approach has been taken on behalf of the investors. Tax neutrality comes up all the time, and that is literally tax neutral, not to unreasonably bring forward tax or unreasonably defer tax. So there's a balance to be had there. How that will be achieved is still being developed, as Senator Sherry indicated at lunch yesterday. Importantly, the process must facilitate rationalisation. Now, that sounds a pretty basic kind of thing to say, but the ultimate test of the process is going to be whether it's used or not, and this obviously requires a balance to be struck. Some would argue that we can just rely on the deep pockets of product providers to overcome any version of an over-engineered process that might exist. However, if the result of that is that we end up eliminating probably the only willing sponsor to the whole process, then the process may not be used and therefore it's no longer effective. Not all product providers have deep pockets that the politicians and public might associate with industry leaders, so the process needs to be cost-effective across products of vastly different scale. And further, not all product rationalisation initiatives deliver huge benefits to the product provider. So no matter how deep the product provider's pockets may be, there are small products in large companies that do not necessarily warrant justify a huge expensive process to be followed by the product provider if they're to get through the rationalisation process. So care must be taken to have a realistic process that tries to balance these things out, and it's not easy to necessarily find that balance. And the other key principle, the last one, is certainty of outcome. If a sponsor is going to put their money on the table and get one of these projects going, they would like to be fairly certain that all members will be exited from that product and placed in something different at the end. If there's no certainty of outcome, then the likelihood of participating in or initiating the processes is low. So where does that leave us? Well, those things are hard to argue with, although some of you may have some different views and we'll be interested to discuss those, but they tend to be the things that bring people together. What comes of that is some basic questions. Who wins in this process is one question. What products is it going to be applied to? Who's going to decide on whether a rationalisation mechanism or process will proceed? How will they decide? What sort of protection will be in place for the investor? And how will it be implemented? Welcome. So this is what we'll talk about, because once we start getting into the detail is where we start getting into the point where we can have a little bit more debate. So who wins? Is it the investor or the product provider? I'll leave you to work out which is which there. Well, my view is clearly the investor must win, because we must focus on developing a product rationalisation mechanism that protects and ideally enhances the position of the investor. The rationale for this statement is simple, because it's very difficult for the industry to expect support from the wider community and politicians for increased powers if the position of investors is not protected. So having said that, I'd also say that, well, product providers must win. The mechanism has to be effective. It needs a willing sponsor. And so as the product provider is about the only sponsor who's standing around in this process, they have to win as well. So the challenge in designing this process is that we seem to have a paradox. Unless everybody wins, then essentially no one wins. No one will win because we won't get a process. If the customer doesn't win, there will be no political support. No one will win if the process is over-engineered to the point that the sponsor walks away. So getting a balance is crucial. They're not two factors that we trade off against each other, as indicated by the little cartoon I managed to find, but they're effectively joint goals in the whole process. So I summarise that balance in setting an objective for the product rationalisation mechanism, and I would say that the objective is that we should protect the interest of investors when transferring them between products, whilst providing an effective means for product providers to reduce the number of products they administer so that they in turn can reduce processing costs and risk. There goes a pen. So what do we apply it to? Well, if the objective of the product rationalisation mechanism is to protect and enhance the position of investors, then it seems a worthwhile and prudent starting point to make the process available only to products that are offered by organisations where there is actually a responsibility to protect the interests of investors. Now, this is where it gets a little bit more controversial. So what does that mean? Well, the Institute implied that they were quite happy for, that was excellent for trustees, responsible entities of managed investment schemes and life companies. The difference comes out in how the decisions are actually made. The core of these responsibilities exist in all of these environments, but to different degrees. So my point that I put in the paper was that we could clarify the obligations of product providers in this instance to be similar to that of the trustee's responsibility in a successor fund transfer regime. There are requirements to give preference to policyholders in the Life Act. There are similar responsibilities in managed investment schemes. The wording's all different and it's not all the same, but there is that one option might be to bring them all up to that same kind of level and get that level of member protection in at that point for this type of decision. So we get on to the next controversial decision, which is who's going to decide. Now, there's a few options here. In fact, there's quite a few options. Investors could decide through a vote. A board of a product provider could decide. There could be an arbitrator. The regulator, APRA or ASIC, could decide, or perhaps a court could decide. Interestingly, in reading most of the submissions that were made to Treasury, very few people actually put a case forward that the investor should actually have a say in this at all, which probably reflects the difficulty that people see in a member voting process. But nonetheless, the public debate seems to come down to the board of the product provider or perhaps some other arbitrator or court. Now, this exists in different cases. Part 9s are ruled by the court, not an effective product rationalisation mechanism, but there is a precedent there. Trustees, the product provider, approves successor fund transfers. So both do exist at the moment. The Institute Horizon meeting in Sydney that I went to had a strong view that boards of product providers shouldn't be in a position to approve this. And that perhaps some arbitrator would. I understand slightly different views might have been expressed in Melbourne, but this is the question that everyone gets excited about. So why would we rely on the board? Well, there is an existing responsibility for boards. If we've clarified that they are to act on and protect the members' or investors' interests, as I indicated on the previous slide, then there is a precedent similar to the successor fund transfer process. There's an existing legal recourse for investors to go back to their boards and seek recoveries if that isn't provided. But of course, there's obviously a lack of transparency, and some would say at that point that allowing a board to do it is completely unacceptable. So how do you overcome that? Could you strengthen that process to provide some additional protection? And firstly, my first point there is, well, yes, you can. Setting a very clear benchmark for what needs to be for the test is critical in this whole process, and in fact the test is probably the most key element or key defence for investor protection in the whole thing. So how high you set the bar in terms of investor protection is a very important thing, and you could set the bar clearly, and you could set the bar fairly high in terms of protecting members. And in that instance, the higher the bar, the less important it is in terms of who actually approves the transfer. If you have a very low bar, then you need guards and a battalion on the gate to protect yourself from every cowboy walking through it. But if you have a fairly high bar, the actual decision process almost becomes one of ticking boxes. So clearly articulating what the bar is critical. Second is certain independent external advice to be considered by the person who's making the decision, even if it was the board. That I see as good governance in the current environment and commonly followed by trustees and other boards. And regardless of who approves the actual advice, independent expert advice is a common thread across all possibilities at the moment. And so, given that it is a common thread, the quality of that independent expert advice is actually going to be very critical to the level of protection provided to investors across the board. I'd note, obviously, some people, particularly because we've all got a bit of a vested interest here, that the Institute of Actuaries and all actuaries would be well placed to provide that advice. I would also note that with a product rationalisation, there are many aspects to a product. Some of those are legal, some of those require consideration of the detail of investments, and it may be that it's not just the actuary, so it may not be one independent expert that's providing advice. It might actually be a range of experts. Thirdly, an additional piece of protection could be regulatory oversight, and depending on the bar and how high that's been set, regulatory oversight could simply be, have you followed due process, or it could actually be review of the decision-making in more detail. So there's different degrees to which that piece of protection could be dialed as well. Okay, so that's one situation with the board. The arbitrator or court, whilst the attraction of this is that the arbitrator is clearly independent, but the debate about who the external body might be still hasn't fleshed out exactly how that role would work, and there needs to be a lot more work done to clarify that. The attraction of independence is good. The questions, though, are, well, what would their legal responsibility be? Do they receive legal indemnity from the product provider, or do they have to somehow or other stand behind their own decisions? Is their word open to challenge, or is it the last word? And some attraction to courts is that it might be a better way of actually being the last word and less open to challenge. What's the expertise of an arbiter? Would they simply be about in the same position as a board or a similar group of expertise where they would then rely heavily on the independent expert advice? I suspect that's probably the case. They couldn't rely solely on statements by the product provider because they wouldn't be... As there would be that bias situation, but they would have to rely on statements by the product provider because they wouldn't be in a position to know the issues that product provider's actually facing, so there'd be a balance to be struck there. An arbitrator will introduce a level of cost, and if you had a small legacy product with perhaps only 1,000 members, a small number of members, well, is an arbitrator or court process going to be cost effective? If we're also saying that we've got a uniform process across all product groups, are we then taking away the right of trustees to execute a successor fund transfer? And what are we saying about trustees in the past to the extent that are we saying they haven't actually executed their responsibilities sensibly? And I don't think that's the case at all. So I sort of see lots of questions come up around particularly the arbitrator, and it's an interesting debate, but there's different levels to it, and there's some detail to be fleshed out. It's probably the most vocal point in the debate, but if I step back from it, my observation is that the introduction of a separate decision maker is another form of investor protection that we're seeking to put in place, which may or may not be warranted. Now, whether it's warranted or not really depends on what sort of protection we have. So an arbitrator is only a form of investor protection. What sort of protection is in place for the member? And I think this is actually where the debate would be best focused, because if we understand that, then other decisions start to fall into... there's context then for the need to put other things in place. Now, the test is, in my mind, the most crucial thing. Setting the bar at a level that clearly protects investors must surely provide the primary safeguard. More work needs to be done on the test. Everyone's got very excited about the who decides question, and we need to flesh out the test in a bit more detail and spend more time on what it means, what the words actually mean, in order to provide primary context for this whole whole discussion. Independent professional advice is another form of protection, and their role would obviously be to review whether the principle of protecting the investor has been satisfied and whether the supporting tests had actually been met and done diligently and the correct conclusions were being drawn. Advice would be directed towards the decision-making body and it would be separate from the management of the entity who, or the product provider. Most importantly, with independent professional advisors, it's probably going to be a common thread in whatever process comes up, so it's something to think about. Mitigation, where some members are adversely impacted, payment of benefits is payment for loss of benefits is a or payment for compensation for adverse impacts is considered part of the process. Treasury's test was actually not necessarily one equivalence of rights, which is moving a bundle across, is one test, but another test proposed is not necessarily to move a whole bundle of rights across in an equivalent sense, but to contemplate potential loss of rights or loss of benefits replaced by appropriate compensation. So obviously that can't be done holus bolus, there's a limit to that, but there is scope for a more a slightly lower test, if you like, where compensation comes in. And with these types of changes, there will be adverse impacts on members that need to be considered. Communication is obviously a form of investor protection, giving, particularly pre-communication, giving investors ample opportunity to know what the changes are and ample opportunity to move to somewhere else of their own volition if they can, which doesn't apply equally to all products. If you were doing this to a lifetime annuity or you're doing it to a product with a legacy savings product with high exit fees, it's not so easy, but with some products there's a protection in communication. Monitoring responses to communication and acting accordingly is another form of demonstrating that you're listening to your investor base. Regulatory oversight, the due process has been followed, is also a form of protection. So, a complaints mechanism also is a necessary form. So there's lots of forms of protection. The primary form, though, is setting the bar appropriately and being satisfied that the test has been set high enough that basically if you can clear the bar, members are fundamentally protected. A post-implementation review would be another one. So what do I see as happening here? Well, there's a principle and there's detailed tests. That's how I envisage the process. That's not a statement of anyone else. Those detailed tests are drilling down to all of the individual components and identifying areas of disadvantage and dealing with those appropriately. So, it will look at equivalence of rights because there'll be the legal clauses. You will look at the value of your entitlements before and after. You will look at the suitability of replacement investments. You will look at how those investments are valued, the liquidity of those investments, the treatment of investors on death. Obviously, insurance is part of this process. Fees and charges and general levels of security. So, there's a lot of detail to go through to satisfy yourself that a product rationalisation process can be implemented. And a little quote from Spider-Man's father was suggested by my son there because it is one of those things that if you're going to have the power to exit someone out of their contract that they bought and move them somewhere else, then there is a great burden of responsibility that comes with that power. And that will need to be taken very seriously. Okay, implementation, the little quote up the top, I'm not sure where that came from, my son turned up with that one as well, which I thought was appropriate. Aim lower and think smaller. We must consider, there's a debate around, do we consider the individual investor? Well, at the end of the day, we do have to consider the individual investor. The weight of the decision might not necessarily require every individual investor in every circumstance to be better off or no, absolutely no detriment, but nonetheless we will need to consider the individual investor, and it's in the detail and picking up the detail from the outset that will give you a successful implementation or a successful product rationalisation project. Give up. You have to be prepared to give up benefits to the investor. There's absolutely no doubt that we have to find ways in this where the investors will be better off in some regards. And have a cup of coffee. Take time with the planning. Don't rush into this. Take the time with the planning and implementation to ensure things that can be completed accurately and as intended. And there's a whole bunch of things to be done. They were covered this morning, so I won't go over them again. That's about half an hour, so I'm thinking I might just summarise there and then see if there's any discussion. So what have I done? I've discussed the principles that we might consider in developing a new product rationalisation mechanism, and the principles, I think, tend to draw people together. The detail of how those principles will work are the things that will drive us apart. The most noted in that sense is the vocal debate around who should approve, who should have the power to approve a product rationalisation decision, and the circumstances in which it might be applied. Now, that debate around who approves, to my mind, is secondary to the types of member protection that should be in place, and who approves. A well-protected investor will, anyone could approve the decision. In the right circumstances, therefore, a strong test that protects the investor could permit the product providers to be empowered with this decision-making capability, as is the case with an SFT, and qualified by the fact that the trustees have a level of duty to members that could be put in place in other environments. If it wasn't there already, it's at least partially there. There would need to be supporting independent advice. There would need to be clear expectations about the decision-making process. There would need to be a supporting disclosure regime, and there would need to be a complaint mechanism to go with it. I've noted that successful implementation is all about the attention to detail. It's a costly project, it's an expensive project to undertake, and it does require a willing sponsor. But a good process will be of benefit to investors. It needs to be of benefit to sponsors as well, and this balance is going to be critical to find the right balance as the new process gets defined. The test of the process will not only be the impact on investors, but also whether it attracts willing sponsors and whether it's used. No matter what the level of investor safeguard is, it won't be of any benefit to investors if it's never used by anyone. That's probably it in a nutshell, and I'd welcome any discussion.
Thank you very much, Guy. I think he's thrown a few questions out to those of us here, particular points of view, so please feel free to ask a question or make a comment. Can I ask you to come to the microphone, identify yourself, and then ask the question? Bruce.
Bruce Vincent. Firstly, Guy, thanks for writing the paper and thanks for having it up there so early. I've printed it off. I will read it, but I have thought about the topic.
Thank you.
Certainly the benefit of having the other meetings, the Horizon meetings, was very useful, and I may, in fact, reinforce the view that came from Sydney. I'd like to speak about the perspective of a life office, so I'll talk about policyholders rather than members, and I think there is a distinction there. And I'd like to just talk about some practical principles in that environment. I think the first thing is there must be some demonstrable benefit to the group of policyholders. And once we say that, I think we start then to start ruling out risk ones. There are certainly conversations in Sydney about, and there seem to be conversations about getting out of contracts which now appear difficult. I think that we have to put that to one side. So the first practical principle, there must be a demonstrable benefit to the group of policyholders. I think the other one is that we need to invoke this where it's impractical or impossible to communicate with the policyholders. So I think that then means that a large body of superannuation business where there is an associated trustee, it's easy to communicate with the trustee. The trustee is the policyholder. Presumably contract terms can be changed appropriately under the existing processes. If that's the case, well, then what we're left with is the ordinary policies, deferred annuities, and life investment policies that are issued to a wider group of trustees. And there I think I favour something similar to the Part 9 process, a Part 9 light, because the Part 9 has worked well. I think it encompasses all the relevant protections, and I think a key point that was mentioned is that it produces some sense of finality. So whether that's a full court process or a court-sanctioned process, I think that was probably echoing what the Sydney meeting said, yep. And I'll say it again. So I'm sure there's other issues in terms of, you referred to members, so presumably there's issues for trustees in making decisions, but I think from a life company's perspective, it actually narrows down to a few sets of policies.
Thanks, Bruce.
As a comment, yeah, I'll comment on that. Thank you, Bruce. Demonstrable benefit to policyholders is a fair point, and it comes down to it's the setting the bar is important, and if that's clear and we've formed a clear set of expectations about how that's going to be demonstrated, then I think that's central to the whole process. I envisage almost a perhaps like a good practice guide from APRA, expanding on these things, a fair bit of detail on what's expected promulgated in the industry, because getting the test right and getting clear expectations about what needs to be achieved to demonstrate that the test has been satisfied is very central. I see that as the central part of protecting the investor. Part 9 light is interesting. And I guess in my mind, I'm not clear on once it goes to the court, there's an existing set of rules and things around that. So there's more the concerns I have about an arbitrator and how that would work, or the unanswered questions I have about the arbitrator go away somewhat when it goes to the court. What the light means is to be nutted out, and it does need, and that needs a bit of thought, because the risk and concern obviously is that if Part 9 light isn't light enough, it becomes too expensive, and then for smaller product groups, it makes the process ineffective. So it's certainly an area of discussion, and at the end of the day, if we're for a life company, in the life company climate, we are cancelling a person's contract and putting them into a new contract without their input, then the mechanism for doing that is possibly most naturally the court. So it's possibly more challenging to come up with a process where we a successor fund transfer type process from a legal perspective that could be overlaid on top of a life company, that the detail of the legalities of that have less precedent when we get into the contract environment. At a principal level, I don't know that it's that different, because in a way there is an implied contract between a trustee and a member, and an implied contract between a responsible entity and a unit trust person. So the principle at law mightn't be much different, but the mechanism for doing it and the established court mechanism is. So they're good points, and how that all pans out in the final proposal put forward by Treasury will be quite interesting, because it pans some principles and down to some practicalities.
Tim Chambers, thanks, Guy. I was just going to sort of raise an issue, because I think it's a very real issue, and I was just really raising an example of a case which we've got at the moment, where I'm at AIG Life, and we've got a small block of about 200 unit link policyholders, and we only really write risk business. We've got this old legacy block from over 20 years ago. I mean, there's only 200 of them left, but we've got our own little statutory fund for these 200 people, and what we'd really like, the cost of all the administration, all the compliance and everything else that goes around, it's really quite significant, setting all the unit prices, et cetera, making sure all this is being done properly, that we can never recover enough. So, we're losing money on it, and we kind of know that. So what we'd really like to do is to be able to take them out of there, and to try and find a mechanism to do that is actually extremely difficult at the moment. And, what we're looking at is providing an offer to these people, an incentive. So I think, the core principle is that the investor has to be better off. And, of course, it's not that straightforward, because they haven't just got a unit link policy. They've got some risk riders on top of it. So you've got to make sure that, those benefits are all reasonably taken account of. And so we're quite prepared to offer them a nice incentive to do this, but we can't just force them to do it. We can only really do it on an optional basis now. That's also compounded by the fact that, because this is an old legacy product from years ago, that only, I think, about 70 of these policyholders we don't actually have a known address for. So you can't actually contact them to even advise them of the offer. So it does make it really quite difficult. And so at the moment, we really don't have this kind of mechanism that we can get rid of this. We can kind of reduce it by making an offer to as many of these as we can contact and see whether it's, you know, the offer's big enough for them to adopt it. But ultimately, we're just going to be left with this little block that, you know, there's not really much we can do with, and it's really quite a problem. So I'm quite hopeful that maybe something sensible will come out of it. But I do see that I do think that in the end it can be a win-win, ultimately, that it's got to be a win for the investor, but I think it can be a win for the provider as well, where they're seeing a lot of costs that are just being wasted, in a sense, on something, and they could they'd be much better off to provide, you know, some of that benefit to the policyholders and avoid that cost themselves. So I think it can be a win-win. But if it goes to, you know, something where you've got to take it to the court, I mean, as soon as you get the lawyers involved, well, you know, costs are just going to go through the roof, and there's no way that in the end it's going to be a win-win. So, or certainly not for the provider, so they wouldn't bother doing it. And so it's a real issue for those small products. So I kind of agree with that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of expectation that this is, well, the industry's done a great job in saying how big an issue this is, and the implication is that big issues can have big solutions, and actually the issue is a replicated problem of lots and lots of those kind of scenarios. Some are large, but not all of them. Some issues are large groups of products, but not all of them, and your example's not uncommon. Have you thought about terminating the statutory fund?
Yeah, just perhaps a question from left field, because this is not the area I practice in, but in the super area you have lost member accounts that are necessarily transferred, and I wonder whether there's a process where, in fact, the life space, you could have lost policyholder accounts that are then earthed or transferred into some central.
Lost monies go to ASIC generally at the moment, and that's a possibility. So sending lost members off to, you know, declaring them lost and agreeing with the regulators that it's appropriate to transfer their benefits to ASIC might be part of that solution. That, you know, if you were terminating the statutory fund, you'd then have a bunch for whom you wouldn't be able to pay the money to, obviously, so that would go off to the regulator as lost monies. If you've got risk riders, then the question is terminating their entitlement to a death benefit is obvious. That then gets problematic. So offering an alternative or providing some kind of alternative might be in the form of a death benefit through some other product, even though it probably wouldn't make any money, but would at least facilitate getting rid of the major issue, might get you close enough to a solution that was palatable and at least get rid of all the unit pricing risks and things that are associated. So just a thought. Happy to find out a bit more and chat about that if you like. But, yeah.
Margaret Gardner, just a couple of questions. What about previous Part 9s, which have guaranteed some form of benefit? One assumes one would have to take those into account and never pay less than that. The other one is, how long does the complaints mechanism last? Why I'm interested in that is you can switch something which at this point is brilliant, and 10 years later, because of investment markets, turns out to not have been such a good decision. I mean, you wouldn't want a one-way option against you for the client to always be able to come back and say, but if you'd have left me in that product, I'd have actually done better now.
Correct. Yeah.
in the past, I couldn't.
Yeah. So the first one was Part 9 guarantees. Well, they were just form part of their existing rights and benefits that would need to be weighed up. So obviously if they've got some guarantee in there in any shape or form, wherever it's come from, it goes into the mix. So yes, and I don't really see that as any different to a guarantee or some kind of benefit in their existing policies. The complaints mechanism thing's interesting because with the benefit of hindsight, you might always be able to come back and think, well, actually, that wasn't the brightest deal. Now, there's a couple of things with that. One is if you do rationalise your existing product completely, then the point of comparison may no longer exist. So the ability to do that might be somewhat diminished. And it becomes quite quickly an argument about what might have been and a very hypothetical argument. So that's impossible to resolve. So there's a practical limit on what can be resolved, and therefore I have suggested that maybe there should also be some limit on the timing of complaints, because whilst the decision is current, it's really about, is this decision the correct decision now, rather than after 10 years, was it the right thing or not? Well, you could never resolve that, and so there is a practical limit on the sorts of complaints. You might, though, get complaints, there's that sort of complaint. There's another sort of complaint that might be often in the detail of individual policies and things like that. Claims might be paid or excluded in certain circumstances, particularly around, you know, active war duties, armed forces service, army reserve service, foreign country TPDs. There's lots of little clauses where things may or may not be paid that are different between different contracts that you may never know. You probably couldn't tell if you've got someone in the army reserve in a war zone who's about to be, there's things you just can't assess, and you probably won't know unless it actually happens to someone. Someone made their point about risk products being harder. The risk products are harder because there's a lot more contractual terms in them, and getting most of those issues, the issues need to be considered in a sense for products with rider benefits anyway. Superannuation funds provide insurance, and the ASFT, they need to consider all these things and weigh them up. But it will come down to some things that can never be decided, never be identified until maybe someone in that circumstance does actually become totally and permanently disabled in those narrow set of circumstances, in the right postcode or whatever it happens to be, that perhaps would have been paid under one contract that wouldn't necessarily be paid under the other. Now, those examples are probably the most tangible for where the complaints mechanism might be used for be utilised for a longer period. If it was known and foreseeable that you had everyone in a war zone in the Army Reserve and you were taking away their cover, well, you wouldn't meet the hurdle. But, I'm only talking about where it's those small groups, absolute minorities, that you probably can't even identify. And there is value in a complaints mechanism, or there's protection provided by a complaints mechanism for a longer period of time in those circumstances that might have more legs as a complaint than if I had been in one, the investment performance would have been better or wouldn't have been. I do also envisage that we're going to move people between fairly similar investment structures and investment portfolios. I'm not thinking people are going to be, from cash to high growth or whatever those kind of scenarios might be. I'm envisaging that the investment advice is going to move people from similar types of portfolios with similar types of exposures. Won't be identical performance, obviously, but it would be expected to be similar over the longer term kind of performance. Yeah.
Next question, comment? Perhaps from the chair I can look back for.
My name is Paul Swinhoe. I should first of all declare that I'm on the Institute's Task Force for Product Rationalisation. I thought it was useful to point out the different roles of, I guess, that the bar plays and the arbiter. I expect the bar will not be a precisely defined bar. It will contain principles that need to be judged as to whether they've been met or not. Clearly, if you've got a situation where all investors are better off, then you've cleared the bar, however it's described, and therefore we're going to be talking about situations where there is some element of judgment involved. I think it's helpful to separate the assessment of the situation from the decision-making. For example, if you're moved from a product with a 1.5% guaranteed fee to a product with a 1% fee, with the product provider having the right to increase that to 2%, are you better off or not? Is that a good product rationalisation, or is that a bad product rationalisation? Should that be above or below the bar? I don't imagine the bar will be explicit about that, and therefore someone will need to make a judgment as to whether that is indeed in policyholders' or members' interests. Since the board is going to be the organisation that is recommending this particular rationalisation process, then there will be presumably an expert to assess who the winners and losers are and in what circumstances, to put it back to the board to then make a decision after they've been expertly advised is sort of a circular argument and puts the board in a very difficult position because they've kind of prejudged it, which is why I'm keen for an arbiter to be a person or a body that would be making the final decision. I'm inclined to think a court is too hard. I think the, you know, the MetLife Challenger decision by the court has kind of undermined their credibility for making sound decisions on exactly this sort of topic, and therefore an arbiter with greater expertise would be a benefit. I think I'd disagree with Bruce, though I like to agree with Bruce, that there needs to be a demonstrable benefit to the policyholders. They've entered a non-participating contract, or talking about the people who have, then I think that as long as they are not materially disadvantaged, then they're adequately looked after. And they should have no expectation of benefiting from this process. They may well get some intangible benefits, such as, you know, lower operational risk within the organisation that is managing them. I don't imagine Bruce treats that as a demonstrable benefit. And I think that is, to my mind, that is good enough.
Okay.
I'll stop there.
Thank you. I did think about the demonstrable, but there are the successor fund transfer regime in terms of acting in members' interests doesn't necessarily mean it has to provide a benefit, it just has to be not adverse. So that is a useful distinction to make in terms of whether or not the members need to be significantly better off and what that might mean, or whether they just have to be moved to something that's the same. The trick is with product rationalisation is that we're looking to move people to more modern open products as a rule to get scale, or to move them to something common, so the contract is changing. So there are some swings and roundabouts in the process, and I think it's reasonable to want generally the swings and roundabouts to be in the favour of the member rather or investor rather than necessarily come out neutral, if that could possibly be evaluated, because some of these things will be subjective. So the more we seek to get streamlining and scale out of rationalisation, the more things will change in terms of what the policyholder is offered or the investor's offered, and therefore the more judgmental it perhaps gets. So perhaps at that point you'd look to push the pendulum at least a little bit in favour of the member to avoid doubt that you've acted in the wrong way. The decision-making point's interesting. And I think there's lots of debate to be had. I guess I come back to, we don't, and the Institute didn't, don't see a problem with the successor fund transfer process. We don't see a problem with the trustees making the decision in regard to successor fund transfers. In taking that view, would we take the successor fund transfer process and raise the decision-making process there at the same time? Now, the Institute, in its submission, didn't suggest that was the case. It suggested that perhaps leave that process alone. So I think there's arguments for a lot of... Your points are valid. I'm not disagreeing with your points. I think there's a lot of debate to be had, and I think... The point you touched on is whether this test is going to be clear, and in a way that the clearer and more prescribed it is, the clearer the bar is, and therefore once it's clearer that an organisation is meeting it, then it becomes less important how the approval is, and we haven't seen what the test will be yet. We've seen lots of principles. I think the discussion in the public debate has been around the principles of the test and what equivalence of rights might be and what no disadvantage might be and those kind of things. But drilling down to exactly what it is in terms of how it's going to work needs some detail added, I think, to then make the context of these other decisions. Yeah.
Duncan Rawlinson, Guy, thank you for your paper. I should also declare that I'm a member of the task force.
The task force is coming out in force at the end of the session.
I won't cover the same ground, but I do endorse Paul's comments. A couple of extra observations. The task, unfortunately, we kind of made a decision within the task force that, well, let me back up. There's a lot more work that we've done behind the output that's come from the task force thus far. Each of us sort of broke away, and a good example would be the test. We'd done sort of separate thinking and distilled it into a short little paper around what we think the bar should be. Issues of discretion, the sorts of issues Paul's raised, we've done thinking around those things. But unfortunately, in hindsight, we took a decision winter last year, once the Treasury paper came out and we needed to respond to that, well, we'll put that up, put the distillation of all of that work on hold, and we haven't come back to it yet. So I absolutely agree. You know, the proof's going to be in, well, exactly what does this test look like, how high is the bar, and a range of other issues that you've rightly raised. But, you know, some of that thinking has been going on, so hopefully that'll come to the fore sooner rather than later. But a couple of observations. On a personal level, we had a briefing early on in the task force from a lawyer around the successor fund transfer process. I've seen this from two ends. I've seen this from being a trustee, but then I've seen it from hearing from a lawyer many of the other things that go on in a successor fund transfer that I wasn't aware of. I have to say to you, it was a real eye-opener for me and something of a surprise as to how successor fund transfers seem to be operated by some. Not so much the transfer itself, but once it's transferred, what is then possible within the succeeding fund, if I can call it that, and what happens to the members that have come in relative to all the other members within the fund. Now, I'm no trust law expert. I just make the observation that, yes, successor fund transfers are fairly clearly defined, but as presented by a lawyer who seemed to have quite an involvement in the process, they seemed to express the view that there was rather more that could be done in practice when sort of viewing the thing in the round than perhaps the letter of the successor fund transfer provisions may have contemplated, can I say? But on the about board decision, because I think this is really a crux of the issue, I absolutely agree with Paul. There does seem to me to be a fundamental issue of the board firstly wearing two hats. I acknowledge that the Life Act could change and maybe make that point clearer, but the reality is a board member does wear two hats. There are things that exist that determine how they make their decisions, but the reason we came down where we did was fundamentally a trustee wears one hat. A board member wears two. And that, in a nutshell, I think was why we came out where we did. The observation I just wanted to make, though, was I don't see this as all upside for advocates of the board making the decision. Yes, I agree that perhaps the more stringent the test, maybe the greater the case. But I'd also suggest that there is some risk that if the board were making the decision, then a different set of arguments might be made as to whether there should be a policyholder advocate involved in the process. And if anyone wants to know how nasty that process can get, well, just take a look at the role of the policyholder advocate in the UK with inherited estates. I have made the observation, and it remains my view, that we really don't want to end up there when it comes to thinking about product rationalisations. The last point I just wanted to make was, I think you rightly made the point that one of the principles was that there should be a principle of facilitating usage. Those weren't your words, but it was to that effect. And I suppose it worries me that if, in order to get the board as the approver, it requires a test that is so high that it would choke off usage, that seems to me to be inherently counterproductive. So I think there are a number of very real challenges in carrying the day that the board should be ultimately the decider of a proposal that they themselves have ultimately overseen the development of.
Okay, thank you. I guess I'd make a couple of comments there. You made some comments about successor fund transfers, and it is interesting. I don't think I want to stand up here and say that process is infallible, and we do see quite varying views or advice from the legal fraternity on what's possible in a successor fund transfer. It does come down to good governance and clear thinking, but nonetheless, it's sometimes I've also been a little surprised at the range of views expressed around that process. I won't comment about the approval process, we've gone over the ground and the bell's rung, but I would just say it's good that you've done some work on what the test should be. Doubtless this will be a topic of discussion at the Treasury panel, and Rob should be eagerly armed with all of that work, and it's certainly timely to have it all dusted off because, to my mind, and that's probably the place to start as to finish as the door opens, is I think that is the... Nailing that will enable all other decisions to be made with a sensible context. So That probably is my principal point and probably where I should draw a full stop. So.
Thank you, Guy. The door is now being opened. Lunch is before us, so I'm not going to attempt to summarise because I'll just be delaying your lunch and I don't want to do that, otherwise you might hit me. But can I ask you to join with me in thanking Guy for, I think, being a very useful and well-presented presentation today.